I thought I should, it would be a good idea to start with an overview of, okay, and here it is, of what I think we should contemplate today. As David said, the issue is cortical maps, and I partitioned this presentation in four steps, essentially. I think it is a good idea to start with going through various evidence that maps, the spatial representation of features or of the sensory surfaces, is a widespread phenomenon. In fact, it's a general principle for the representation of function in cortex. To spend some time reassuring ourselves that this structural principle, the fact that there are maps, is actually of relevance for perceptual processes, not just the epiphenomenon. And to remind ourselves that learning processes, the acquiring skills or getting better at things, either in perception or in behavior, there's good reason to believe that this is accompanied by the reorganization of the maps in the brain. After this survey of various experimentally obtained evidences, I would like to spend the second half of the morning session treating like the most elementary model for the formation of neural maps, which happens to be the Kohonen model. This is a very simple and elegant formulation, and it happens to be that you can work out almost everything that is understood today in a few lines, so this will be a blackboard session. In the afternoon, I'm planning to present you theories and results on the formation of columns in the visual cortex in particular. So this is like the general setting of map formation models, and this is the using them to describe and understand patterns in the visual cortex. And if we get through with this, I would like to close this session by reviewing the recent, largely experimental progress that has been done. And the reason for this is that if you are interested in this topic and you grab the average very good textbook, you will be perfectly misled, because almost every experiment that has been performed during the last 10 years has turned out different than people had thought and theorists would have predicted. So to get an even view of this of the state of this field, I find it very important, but also it will be hopefully a bit amusing to go through these twists and turns the study of maps has taken during the last few years. Okay, and in the end, it would, of course, be great to discuss what open questions are there and what challenges one should really address here. Okay, so maybe that's more a discussion issue. Okay, so let's start with reviewing the phenomenon of maps. Presumably, the most widely known map is the representation of the cerebral cortex, is the representation of the body surface, the so-called homunculus in the primary somatosensory cortex. So what people found there, first in like lesion experiments in humans, but with all kinds of methods, is that the body surface is represented in, so the primary visual cortex, which is about this portion of your brain, in a fashion that preserves the order of the body parts. So, for example, here in the middle of the brain, you have the foot representation adjacent to the representation of the neck, of the trunk, of the hand. There's a representation of the face that has adjacent parts represented by adjacent neurons, and so on. And the second thing that already hits the eye in this case is that this representation is not does not respect the proportions of the actual body of the human form. You see, for example, that the representation of the hand, which is heavily innervated and very much used, is much larger than, say, the representation of I don't know what this is, of the knee. Yeah? The representation of the body surface in the somatosensory cortex is also that system where we have the most clear evidence that this is not a fixed wiring scheme, frozen mapping of the sensory surface, of the body surface onto the brain, but that this is a system or organization which may change throughout life. The first indications of that came from lesion experiments by Mertzenich that followed the fate of the representation of this hand area. So this is a surface view of the part of the somatosensory cortex schematized that represents the five fingers of a monkey. So this is the first, presumably the thumb and the other four fingers. And what was done in those experiments was to remove one of those fingers, let the monkey survive for a period of a few months, and then examine the mapping of the other fingers. And what people found, or what Mertzenich's group found, Mertzenich and Kass, was that the area that was previously processing information from that missing finger was taken over by the adjacent fingers, such that the
How do you explain the sensation of ghost limbs that people have when they have, say, a finger removed?
Okay, that's
but they can still feel it.
Point five. Yeah. It is. I don't know the correct theory for this, but it is assumed that this similar effects are besides this. It must be. What people believe that work on this is that the interpretation of the activity in this region may not have changed, but the activation may already have changed, such that the stimulation of body parts that feed into this now is interpreted by the rest of the brain as an activation of the missing limb. And I'm not really up to this literature, but there's very interesting work on how to cure phantom pain by aiding the progress of the reorganization of the respective cortical parts. Birnbaumer is studying this very heavily in Tübingen in Germany. Yeah. But I mean, this touches very deep issues. What perceptual qualities are associated with these activities, and how comes that in some subjects the reorganized cortex is really viewed, activity is viewed by the brain as the activity of the adjacent finger, and another is viewed as the pain of the missing finger. But one could argue, or many people have argued regarding these experiments, that this is plasticity in response to a loss of a body part, but it does not mean that it may be analogous to a learning process, but it does not mean that these maps really undergo changes when an animal intactly learns to achieve a task. And this gap has been closed largely by Greg Reconsoni, also in the group, at that point also in the group of Mertzenich. There's a very nice recent review on this, and what he did was, these people stick with this middle finger, I don't know for what reason, but he used the middle finger differently of the monkey. He trained monkeys to discriminate very fine differences in the vibration of a target, the monkey would place his hand on a stimulator, and it would vibrate with 20 hertz, and he should remove, he was trained to remove his hand when the vibration frequency changed. And initially, an untrained monkey can discriminate a change in the frequency of a vibration of this stimulator by it needs to be at as large as 5 hertz. But during a few months of training, these monkeys became capable to distinguish like 1 hertz or 0.5 hertz frequency differences. Also, this stimulation, this experiment was set up such that a very small part of the hand surface was only stimulated. And all analogous to the expansion of the left fingers, in these experiments, Greg found that the representation of the part of this of the hand surface that is engaged in this task is greatly expanded, both in comparison to untrained animals, untrained hands, and in comparison to similar parts of adjacent fingers. And then also the structure of the receptive fields, the size of the region of the body surface from which the neurons can be excited, and also their temporal properties changed. So which is, and this is at this point in time, the most convincing evidence that learning processes are closely accompanied by reorganizational changes of the of brain maps. Right. Bless you. Yeah.
How sharp are they?
I mean, between the fingers, they are very sharp because there are very few units, I think virtually no units that have receptive fields in several fingers in a normal animal or in these trained animals. So another very heavily exploited model system of maps in the somatosensory cortex is the barrel field for various reasons. This is a classical system, everybody should know. Did you introduce it already? Okay. So what should I mention? One thing that gives the barrel field its aids to the popularity of the barrel field in studies of map formation and reorganization is that so this is the represent this these so-called barrels, these patches of staining are the representations of the individual whiskers on the mouth of a on the face of a rodent like mouse or rat. And one nice feature of this system is that these columns, these maps, can be visualized anatomically just by staining the cells. These barrels pop out as conglomerates, agglomerates of neurons, which aids very much the visualization of changes and the mapping of changes. Okay, but maps are not restricted to the somatosensory system. So all the primary senses are represented in their respective cortical areas in maps, and the analogon to the somatotopic representation of the body surface in the somatosensory system for sound and the auditory cortex in hearing is the representation of sound frequencies through the auditory cortex. And these are two examples from largely different animals. This is a surface view of the mouse auditory cortex, and this is a surface view of the auditory cortex of a macaque monkey. And the lines you see are the lines where neurons are located that respond best to a sound beep of 5 kilohertz, 10 kilohertz, 20 kilohertz, 30 kilohertz, and so on. So as the frequency of a sound stimulus is increased, the activated neurons shift systematically throughout the auditory cortex. And this is also basically a map of the body surface, in the sense that the frequencies are mapped and discriminated transformed into a spatial pattern already in the ear, mapped in the cochlea along the axis of the cochlea, and the tonotopic organization of the various brain areas basically results from the topology preserving mapping of the cochlea in the various brain structures. Yep.
What are the two areas?
There are four areas, five. So this is A1, the primary auditory cortex, presumably defined by the fact that it is the area that receives the major input from the thalamus, and the other areas I'm not sure. In the monkey, only A1 receives direct input, and the other areas, the adjacent auditory cortical areas, receive their input from A1. They differ in all kinds of properties of the nerve cells. So, for example, their temporal properties may vary. For example, in A1, most neurons only respond to very brief sounds, to the onset of sounds, and in an adjacent area, there may be neurons that keep firing when the sound of a longer duration is played to the animal, and so on. So there are these borders are physiologically defined by changes in some receptive field property.
This is just for one ear?
The auditory cortex receives information for both ears. The both ears are already integrated at the level of the brainstem in the auditory system, and there are there are different classes of neurons that may either be excited by both ears or excited by one ear and suppressed by the other ear, and so on. And they are also clustered in smaller regions. So you could distinguish regions of different ear dominance in the auditory cortex. Okay, go on. Yeah. Yeah, that's how those maps are obtained. It's in the auditory cortex. Most of the mapping experiments are done electrophysiologically. So really, going with an electrode throughout the auditory cortex, mapping the auditory receptive field of the neurons and determining their stimulus preferences. So far, the maps we have looked at were representations of the body surface. Now, this is not the only thing that is mapped by the cerebral cortex. An extreme example of an abstract feature that may be mapped topographically has been found in the bat brain, and seems to play a large role in the echolocation of that is done by bats. So bats are nightly predators, and they can localize their prey by emitting short sound pulses and analyzing the echo that is reflected by their target, by the prey animal, mostly insects, for example, in this case of the mast-hitched bat that has been extensively studied by Nubo Suga. So there are different aspects of the information a bat can obtain by comparing the pulse, the cry it emits, and the echo that is reflected from the prey animal. So, for example, typically the frequency of the so CF1, CF2, blah blah blah. This is a spectrogram. On the x-axis time, on the y-axis frequency, it depicts at which frequencies there is energy in the sounds heard by the bat. And these sounds are emitted by the bat, and these sounds are the reflected sounds that come back from the target. So there are different aspects of information in this overall sound pattern. One important aspect is that the echo signal is typically shifted from the call of the animal because of the movement or because of the relative movement of the target. If the insect gets closer to the bat, the Doppler shift will increase the frequency of the reflected sound. So this is an example of a bat homing in on an insect. If it is increasing its distance to the bat, the echo frequency would be below that. So one way to check whether you get closer to the prey is to analyze the frequency shift, the Doppler shift between the emitted call and the reflected echo. This does not tell you how close you actually are as a bat to this prey. To obtain this information, the mustached bat adds a frequency modulated part to its call. How is it called?
A chirp.
And this is a signal that has many frequency components that is well localized in time, and the bat can use the delay between the chirp in its emitted signal and the reflected chirp to estimate the absolute distance. You have a question, David?
I'm just curious. Mm-hmm. Is the animal, so it's mapping the harmonics, like you said, but is it also, how does it map the chirp?
There are frequency modulation selective neurons already at the level of the brainstem that have not well-defined pure tone receptive fields, but are triggered by chirps. So there are chirp filters already in the peripheral auditory system of the bat.
What are the experiments about the logic of the mapping? Is it mapped by the rate of frequency shift? Absolute frequency?
No, the maps. Okay, the maps are on the next display. So these features of this sound pattern are mapped in various ways in the bat auditory cortex. With respect to the chirps, there's one area. So this is a side view of the bat brain. And these colored areas are the main areas of the bat auditory cortex, the primary area and various association areas. And chirps are processed, for example, in this one, the FM-FM area according to Suga's nomenclature. And this area has a frequency gradient and orthogonal to this a delay axis, such that the larger the delay between the emitted call and the reflected echo of the chirp is, the farther you go this way. And the delays translate into distances that are, I think, between a few centimeters and about 1.5 meter along this delay axis. There are other areas where the differences in the different harmonic components are mapped. So those reflect the target velocity. And what the neurons there do is to compare the primary harmonic, the basic harmonic component of the call with the higher harmonics of the echo. So that there's a map of this. When you go across this area, you find neurons that have larger and larger detuning between call and echo necessary to be well activated.
So what's the function of the chirp? Why couldn't I measure the delay just in a sine
term? Because you don't know which phase you would like to compare in time. It's much easier with the chirp, right? You would have to use the onset anyway, and with the chirp you have an onset in many frequency channels that can be more easily detected. And so also these signals are emitted such that the in the behavioral relevant regime, the echo overlaps with the call, so that both components are present at the same time.
Yeah. I was going to ask a question. You can get a bit looking at distance ranging by putting in a pulse, right? So when you turn the edge of the pulse, well, it's sharp and fine, and this is a chirp of frequency, right? The fastest you can get into the tweak actually to make something that's sharp and fine. You kind of see that on the right foot, right? The amplitude is going off, right? So you put out a pulse and have it collect back, right?
There's also another aspect, the visible in the bad auditory cortex. We already had at the first map we looked at, which is the selective overrepresentation of certain parts of the sensory surface. So in the primary auditory cortex still basically has a map of the frequency components of the sound from low frequencies to high frequencies, but there's a huge overrepresentation of frequencies around 60 hertz, which is about the frequency, the typical frequency of a call. And the bats use a strategy actually, which is called Doppler shift compensation, to make optimal usage of this enlarged representation. What they do is, when they approach an animal, they lower their own call frequency such that the echo becomes located within this frequency window, which is ex-aggregated in the cortical representation. This is a system. Okay, now I should go back. So this is a very nice example that cortical maps can represent not only the body surface, but highly abstract features that need to be computed by neural operations and are then laid out in a topographic way across the cortical tissue. Now, it also presents a very nice demonstration that this spatial representation of the information in the cortex is what is used by the perceptual performance, or what underlies perceptual performance in these animals. And to do that, Suga's group did experiments in which bats were trained to discriminate artificially generated pulse echo pairs. They were placed sounds composed of a synthesized pulse and an echo signal, and they were trained to flex their leg to kick under certain stimulus. In instances, by being electroshocked, they could prevent an electroshock if they kicked with their leg, and other stimuli did not predict electroshocks, and they were awarded if they did not kick. Or it was considered correct if they did not kick. And then they synthesized those training stimuli such that either the bat has to discriminate the delay time in order to avoid the electroshock, or it has to discriminate the frequency offset between the simulated pulse and the simulated echo. And then they went in those animals and inactivated specifically these areas, the areas responsible for comparing the frequencies and the areas that are mainly involved in processing, in representing the delay of the echo, and found very nice complementary results. So if muscimol is a GABA agonist, so it's like you're putting a lot of inhibitory neurotransmitter on your brain area, which kills off most of the activity, and if they injected this substance into the frequency, the chirp delay sensitive area, the temporal discrimination, so this is the y-axis gives the percent correct responses of the animal, and the x-axis is the time relative to the injection of the agent. So these neurons, these bats were trained to almost perfectly discriminate the stimuli. And when muscimol was injected in the delay processing area, their performance dropped dramatically for, okay, this is for different, for discrimination of different delays. Whereas their ability to detect these Doppler shifts in the basic frequency remained almost unaffected by the inactivation of the delay area. And the reverse thing applies when the this is the example where for the frequency discrimination when the delay area is treated by muscimol. The reverse happens when this primary auditory cortex with the large representation of the shifted signal is inactivated. Then frequency discrimination is fairly is affected, and the delay discrimination is fairly unaffected. So this is a very nice system in which people can selectively disable perceptual abilities that are linked to the map. It is in particular striking to me because there are other places in the brain where there are also neurons selective to delays, to frequency differences, but the stage where they are organized in the map is at the level of the auditory cortex. So you could argue, in principle, there are enough neurons that have still the information, even if you inactivate those areas, but the perceptual ability is lost when they are inactivated.
So the frequency-dependent domain scarps correspond to the frequencies which they
limited? Frequency-dependent. I mean, this is the Doppler shift in kilohertz. So if there is a large Doppler shift, this is this curve. It is easy to detect because there's a large shift in the echo frequency, and it is least affected. But as soon as you go to the finer frequency discriminations, which an intact animal can easily perceive, the ability breaks down.
This is not the frequency,
but the amount of the Doppler shift of the simulated. They didn't do it. This is an incredibly small brain. This is the entire primary, secondary, and so on visual cortex is all in like 2 or 3 square millimeters. So it's very. I don't know. They did not find a protocol to activate individual columns in this very small cortex. Okay, let's wrap this up. Mapping is a general strategy for the representation of sensory information, at least, in the neocortex. Hippocampus is also cortex. There are no maps in the hippocampus, but in the neocortex, most areas are organized in some way topographically and have maps of relevant features and of the processing that is done. It is locally topographically organized. One should keep in mind that this is not just the preservation of the order of some peripheral representation in the mapping to higher brain structures, but may as well be exploited to represent abstract features, which is called a computational map, because the things that are represented in this ordered fashion in the cortical map have to be extracted by means of like computational operations. There's nice evidence. I showed you one example I like very much, that perceptual and motor performance is really linked to these topographic representations, and that learning processes, at least some, are accompanied closely by reorganizations of the maps that are involved in performing the functions and the abilities. So, questions on this? Oh, so I can go on. Yeah.
How does this map reorganization take place at the cellular level, or synaptic level? Is that known?
Yes, presumably there are different processes. One is the strengthening and weakening of existing synapses, but it has been established that also in the adult brain there can be outgrowth and establishment of new connections, both tangentially intracortical connections between neurons in the same cortical area, and also at a larger delay, the reorganization of the input connections. But it seems to take place largely at the level of the cortex and the projection from thalamus to cortex.
So was it demonstrated that, for example, the expansion of the areas due to synaptic
thing? It was demonstrated that the expansion, for example, of this finger representation is accompanied by sprouting. Also, in the visual cortex, there's a similar example where in Gilbert's group, there were this series of experiments on artificial scotomas. And in that case, neurons acquire receptive fields outside of the scotoma. And I think, what's her name? Okay, one postdoc in Gilbert's group, a woman, established that this is accompanied by actual sprouting of horizontal connections that relays information into that. So there's also a very fast change that is presumably not due to synaptic physiology changes, but to the up and down regulation of thresholds and higher excitability, so that hidden inputs can drive the neuron. But there's on a longer term also clear evidence for production of new synapses. Yeah?
I haven't quite understood this mapping of the Doppler shift.
Yeah.
And when you have this experiment, you have first the outgoing frequency and the reflected frequency, and they correspond already to two areas on this map. And then you are saying, if I understood it correctly, mm-hmm. that there is a third area which corresponds to the Doppler shift.
Yeah. So the neurons there are not well activated by individual sine wave sounds, but require a sound in which two frequencies are present, and whether they are activated sensitively depends on the shift of the two frequencies. And this is what is changing throughout this area.
How this computation is done, I don't know.
Probably by convergence at the lower level. So in the cochlea, the frequencies are represented fairly independently, but then there are combination sensitive neurons but the exact mechanisms are not known. That's right. If you're interested in this, I can copy you a very nice review that gives the state of this, of the mechanistic side of this. So okay, the main goal of this presentation is maps and their formation in the visual system. So I would like to shortly remind you on the structure of the visual pathway. Visual information enters the nervous system through the eyes and is transformed into electrical signals by the retina, which the ganglion cells of which send their axons first to the LGN, where they contact relay neurons, which in turn project axons to the primary visual cortex. So the primary visual cortex in mammals is one synapse away from the eye. And as in these other sensory areas we have looked at, it is also represented topographically in the visual cortex. There's a sensotopic map of the visual cortex, which is a map of the retina. And okay, I didn't mention it. This projection is arranged such that the left part of the visual field, which is the nasal retina, which is mapped onto the nasal retina of the of one eye and the temporal retina of the other eye, project to the right brain hemisphere. So these and these are both go to the right LGN and project to the right visual cortex, and this see my retinas both project to the left LGN and to the left visual cortex. So in every hemisphere there's a representation of the half visual field, which is a representation of two half retina matched. And the topography of this has been very nicely displayed by Tutel. What they did was to present the animal with a coordinate system like visual stimulus. And obtain the activity pattern that was induced by that stimulus by the method of 2DG mapping. Are you familiar with this method? Should I mention it? Okay, this is an ingenious technique. It was invented by Russians, right? And the principle is that the animal is injected with a chemically modified sugar molecule, which is taken up by active neurons, but is modified such that it cannot be metabolized. So it, in active neurons, this modified sugar accumulates. Now, what is done to obtain images of brain activity with this method is that this sugar derivative is radioactively labeled. So there's C radically labeled carbon in it. And so the neurons that accumulate the modified sugar, because they are active and take up a lot of food but cannot process it, become radioactive. And what is done after the experiment is that the brain is removed, the cortex is flattened and placed opposite to a photographic film. And the radioactive label then induces the darkening of the film such that, so this is an what is called an autoradiogram. You induced radioactive radioactivity in those neurons that were active, and then record the radioactivity pattern. And you see that the topology of this stimulus is well preserved in the activity by the activity pattern in the brain. But as for the body surface or for these important frequencies in the bed, there's an Gleichung drin geblieben, scheiße. Is distorted such that the center part of the visual field, represented by the fovea, is greatly enlarged in comparison to the peripheral parts. For example, so this section of the visual field and this section of the visual field are represented by these two areas of the cortex, and the progression of the areas is much larger in the visual field than through the cortical representation. So, I mean, the corresponding parts are labeled here. This is the foveal representation. This is one part of the vertical meridian going down. It's represented up here. The upper part of the vertical meridian is represented along this border of the primary visual cortex, and the end of the horizontal meridian is mapped across the visual cortex. But it was realized fairly early that there's an easy guess for the actual functional representation of this mapping. So if you label a position in the visual field by R, the corresponding position in the visual cortex at which information at this position R is then processed is about the complex logarithm. If you code this by a complex number R, And the reason is obvious. These radial lines of how people came to that guess is that these radial lines are represented about by parallel lines, and also the these semicircles are represented by almost parallel lines, and that's just what is performed by a complex logarithm. There's also this guess. Okay, keep it in mind. We will find that it is actually a solution of a map formation model. But this guessed mapping, the complex logarithm, also sparked speculation that the map may actually underlie the processing, visual performance aspect, which is, and the reasoning of the people at that time, was, okay, what happens if you present some stimulus fairly close to the fovea and rotate it? The complex logarithm, the complex logarithm will translate this in a shift, because it's a change of the phase. What happens if you magnify it, if you go closer to this image? It will be a shift in the other direction. So rotations induces shifts of the cortical image in this direction, and proximity, helping larger and smaller stimuli, induces shifts of the image in this direction. So this gave rise to speculations that an invariance could be realized by such a mapping. But this is speculation, and so far no application has really successfully used this principle to achieve invariant recognition of visual patterns.
So you say approaching the island just a shift.
Yeah.
But
approximately.
The shift will be different.
It's a linear shift. Mm-hmm. Approximately.
If you shift the orbit.
If you shift, yeah, the shift will be complicated. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to mention it because it's.
You only want to solve the variance to the different rotation.
Yeah. Yeah. A map in between a somewhat utopic map and a computational map is the map of eye dominance or ocular dominance in the visual cortex. This is a recent example obtained by Horton and Hocking in San Francisco from a macaque monkey. And this displays, so this is a flat mount of the primary visual cortex of a macaque, and the darkly labeled regions are those regions that receive input from one eye, and the pale regions are the regions that receive input from the other eye. And you see that this is a repetitive structure. It has a spatial scale on the order of a millimeter, so the distance between adjacent stripes is about a millimeter. And so you may view this as a computational map because the cortex has to sort out different sources, but also it's basically a map of the left eye represented in the dark regions and the right eye and a different part of the body surface represented in the pale regions. Yeah.
Question. I can't quite see whether the dark, the left dominant region and the right dominant region are actually connected.
They are not. They are disconnected. There are disconnected left eye representations. So it's not a labyrinthine pattern. So. Why do you find this interesting?
Well, it was just a matter that there was some issue of, well, it was connected with what you were saying.
Yeah. Okay, they are.
You were
Yeah.
From some
spatially, many of them, I mean, many of them are connected, some are disconnected. Neurally, they are connected. So there are connections, axons going from one left eye domain to the next left eye domain, irrespective of whether they are topologically connected or not. So those neurons work together. The third classical feature, which is topographically organized, represented in the primary visual cortex, is the orientation preference. You have already had several lectures on orientation preference. The orientation preference is the property of visual cortical neurons that if you stimulate them with a bar of light or a grating of light with a certain orientation, they will exhibit a maximum response. So if you deviate from this orientation, they will in general decrease their response. And when Hubel and Wiesel discovered this property, what they did was in long electrode tracks, so advancing the electrode through the cortical tissue, for every neuron they could identify, determine this preferred orientation and map the preferred orientation of the neurons as a function of their position within the cortex. And what they found was that there is a regular progression. When as you go through the cortex, this angle changes. This is a classical example of a computational map in the visual cortex, because this is definitely not the topology of a structure in the periphery, but is synthesized by both presumably the afferent connections that feed into the visual cortex from the LGN and maybe also intrinsic circuitry. So, and it's the study of those maps has been largely helped by a recently developed experimental technique that has perfected during the past 10 years, and it was introduced yesterday, I understand. So at this point, okay, what the basic principle of these measurements rely on the fact that the brain tissue changes its optical properties in a fashion that is closely coordinated with the neural activity. In regions where neurons are very active, different processes take place that lead effectively to a larger absorption of light in those regions. The prime thing that is claimed by the experimentalists is that there's a different composition of the hemoglobin in the active regions, but also other optical properties change such that if you take an image of a part of the cortex, those regions where the neurons are particularly active will be darker than those where they are less active. Obtaining these very small signals from the reflected light in the presence of stimulation with different with changing stimuli can give you the information to obtain those maps simultaneously in the living brain in a viewing animal. And so there's a movie that we produced a while ago, that is supposed to pedagogically expose the way these maps are obtained. Does it work? Does it play? Ah, it plays, okay. So what did we show? Okay, the first part exposes the how an orientation map is obtained from a piece of cortex. So this is a surface view of the imaged part of cortex. These are the blood vessels. It's a part of the brain that is about 2 point something millimeters times 3 point something millimeters large. It's like a square. That's due to the projection.
Okay.
Also. Okay, to the angle. And then what this movie shows is an idealized version of the stimulus that is used to drive the responses, and the average pattern of the light absorption.
Averaged
over many stimulus representations. Yeah.
The average intensity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is relative to the average intensity and averaged over many stimulus presentations. And you see that when the orientation of the stimulus changes, you have a different pattern. And so what we did was to set the thing in motion and simulate how these activity patterns would change if you would present a stimulus that changes in its orientation. So first of all, you see there's no one-to-one mapping between the stimulus and these activity patterns. At that point, we were quite mesmerized by these things, and that's the reason why this has maybe has some length, this movie. So an important structural element that was found using this, or was finally proven, demonstrated using this technique, is the presence of topological defects in the representation of preferred orientations. And to do that, so we home into one small part of this cortical tissue, and what we did was, so there are regions that have the maximum gray value, and we started to color code the orientation for which they are activated systematically. And okay, it starts now. So this orientation, the neurons activated most by this orientation are then labeled in blue, red, and so on by a complete color circle. And so this reveals that around this singularity point, all the orientations are represented in a circular fashion. And this structure has been dubbed pinwheel because of its visual similarity to the pinwheels people put in their gardens. Actually, there's a pair of pinwheels here. There's one of topological charge define minus one, and the other has the opposite topological charge. And to obtain such a, so the next section of this movie obtains such a color representation of the orientation preference map for the entire region. So the activity sweeps through the cortical tissue, and wherever the maximum activity has been detected, we color code the thing. Now you see here that actually the pattern of the preferred orientation coded in color is fairly rich in these defect points in these pinwheels. Here's one, there's one. Usually the isoorientation domains, those regions that have the same color and activated by the same orientation, connect two of those discontinuities. And there are only the most elementary topological charges present. Now the same technique can be used to obtain the pattern of eye preference. Because the neurons are so well driven by grating stimuli, what is used in these measurements is also grating stimuli, but they are presented only to one eye at a time. So first, the right eye is stimulated by stimuli of four different orientations: the cardinal orientations, horizontal and vertical, and the oblique orientations, the both oblique orientations. And the activity patterns obtained from these stimuli are then superimposed and averaged with respect to the orientation of the stimulus, such that those in the averaged pattern, those regions become dark or are marked that are activated by some oriented stimulus presented to the one eye. I think this has been, this is the last.
Right, so each of these is after you subtract some average?
Yeah,
this
In these experiments, it was over all blanks, all non-stimulus conditions. I think this is cocktail blank, the average of all oriented responses. That's not the way it is done today by most laboratories. Today, people try to subtract the frame just before the stimulus was present, because you know that
you can interpret this picture.
Yeah.
Black,
yeah.
Black is
no, it's
zero.
Mm. Yeah.
But the average will be also has a structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, typically the average has a structure, which is a concern. Yeah. Yeah, right. So one thing, one test one should subject these measurements to, or read it, was to compare the patterns that you can obtain from the one eye and from the other eye. There's no reason in principle that they need to be complementary. However, if this assessment obtains the regions that respond to the one or the other eye, they should be.
That's not my question. Yep. First of all, if you see the spatial patterns, you tend to interpret it as having high activity force on some low activity background.
It
could be that what you see as a spot is actually less activity than the one, because what is abstracted was an
offer. No, but I mean, what is abstract is also not strongly linked to activity. So. So I mean, still it's
the intuition about what the real activity pattern was by looking at this spatial pattern.
I mean, what do you think? Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
Not this data, but the orientation stress is about a 20% modulation.
Mm-hmm.
So any orientation can do activity, say one, changing the orientation, like changing something like plus or minus.
So my
the average signal, how much spatial structure is there in the average signal?
There's a large scale spatial structure, like a gradient over a region of this size. So I don't think this is really linked to a systematic difference in activities. And I mean, what people have done is to verify the preferred orientations by guided electrophysiological recordings, and this gives some a good reason to believe that the dark regions are those
about preferred orientation at a given pixel.
Yeah.
But
okay, differences in orientation, differences in
activity.
Yeah, differences in activity through the cortex. Is a different question than to obtain the best orientation at any point. But, yeah.
So what's the penetration depth of optical?
Excuse me?
What is the penetration depth of
optical? Ask an experimentalist. What people believe is that they can look at the upper layers, like layer 2. What they do is they focus the optics on the surface of the cortex, imaging the blood vessels there, and then, I'm telling what people do, and that is right what I say. And then they shift this focus level a few hundred micrometer below the cortical surface. This does not mean that they really section optically this tissue, but the idea is that they want some. By light diffusion, average signal that comes from a few hundred millimeters and micrometers below cortical surface. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's the scattering length is tissue dependent, but it's maybe 100 microns.
Uh-huh.
So you have to sort of view the light that's going in, it diffuses. There's no real imaging condition. So your depth is about your lateral resolution. You create uh-huh. lateral resolution, like you said, 100, 200 microns. So then you get kind of record from a depth of about 200 microns, that scale. So you're kind of saved by the fact that the blood vessels are mostly radial.
Mm-hmm.
There's one.
Yeah. Go on. Ladies first, yeah.
Can I ask show that it was for left and right eye, it was one and the same piece of cortex.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that they appear complementary.
Yeah. Well, you want to see them again?
Yeah, okay. So do you have any working explanation?
This is a... Okay, first of all, I didn't mention this is a squinting cat, a cross-eyed cat. The one eye looks this way, the other way looks this way. In those animals... it's only in squinting cats that ocular dominance counts can be visualized at all in the adult animal. That's the reason these experiments were done in squinting cats. And the cause of that is that because of the squint, and this afternoon I will tell more about squint, is the signals of the two eyes are very much uncorrelated, which makes the segregation of the left and right eye channels very sharp. In the normal cat, there are large regions that are responsive to both eyes, where neurons are binocular.
Does that show up in the map?
The maps differ. What do you mean with show up?
This the binocular activity.
The binocular regions are those where left and right eye stimulation are not distinguishable in the signal you obtain, and they are most noise sensitive, obviously, because you have to cancel those to find them, but in principle they are obtained. But they are most easily obtained if these are very sharp borders.
What would you predict the pictures would look like if they were normal?
Okay, biologists would think it should be smoothed, yeah. And there's some indication that the columns may be smaller. I'll talk about that. There are one would expect on theoretical grounds that when you change the experience, also the spatial structure of those maps may change. There are mechanisms for that. There's some indication that it actually happens.
Yeah, there's one thing I'm confused by, which is the anatomy. So how come it's right eye and left eye and not right hemifield and left hemifield?
There's a right hemifield column, which is your left brain and the...
Okay.
Left.
But within the LGN, the right and left eye, so after the chiasm, the right and left afferents are segregated in the LGN.
Yeah, in layers, but
in layers.
Such that
even
they are
they come together to the same half of the LGN.
They overlap and then they segregate. So these are the two semi-retinas that map to this piece of cortex. In the LGN, in the adult LGN, there are layers. This one goes to, say, this, and this layer, and arborizes the contacts neurons in the LGN. There's a corresponding position in the other eye, where so the stimulus presented on the horopter is mapped, that maps here. Those go into the same what is called projection column in the LGN, but terminate in different layers. But the thing forms such that in the young animal, there are no layers, and they terminate throughout the structure. And then, during a developmental process before birth, these things segregate out.
So initially they're mixed up.
Yeah. That's the classical view. Still good evidence for that.
And is there communication between those layers?
There is communication between them. But it's a bit complicated. There's this perigeniculate nucleus, which is part of the thalamus that I think that it receives input from the cortex. It projects throughout the layers, and targets both cells. So physiologically, there's I think people have found inhibition between different layers, but the mechanism is not clear. Maybe this feedback.
There's a lot of species variation in this map, right?
Yeah, there's a variability in the number of the layers. For example, in the ferret, there are sublayers for the different sender types, for different ganglion cell types in the retina that project to different layers. In primates and cats, it's only left and right eye and type, so X and Y.
But the segregation feature is common. So
yeah, it's even in mice. Yeah.
Yeah, one heavy field. Two points on the retina.
Okay, it's not. If this is the visual field, they look at this hemifield. Okay, I think I'm not finished yet. Need to check that. Okay, movie shown. Using this method, it was for the first time possible to obtain different maps in the same piece of cortical tissue in the same animal. With this 2DG method, it was only possible to represent a single activity pattern in every given animal that underwent the experiment. With optical imaging, you can obtain, in principle, as many activity patterns for as many stimuli that fit into the experimental time window. And this opportunity was used to investigate whether there are geometric relationships between those different representations. In principle, they may ignore each other completely, but okay, there was a long-standing hypothesis brought up by Hubel and Wiesel that there should be a right angle of intersection between the isorientation lines and the isorientation borders. This is a recent example of data obtained to test the geometric relations among different maps. So the colored lines are isorientation lines. The neurons located in the vicinity of such a line prefer similar orientations coded by the color of the line. The dark, thick black lines are the lines that separate left eye dominated parts of the visual cortex from right eye dominated parts of the visual cortex. And this entire data set was obtained from a young cat. So,
and is it a normal cat or
what?
Is it a normal cat?
This is a normal cat. I was right, and this is why I said it's a young normal cat. In kitten, you can still image ocular dominance, but this is somehow lost in the adult, probably by change of the optical properties. But yeah. So this, I think the cats that are used by Mark Hübner are like 6 to 8 weeks old, fairly young, still within the critical period.
The change is due to change in optical properties or change in the map?
Change in experimentalists, or biologists think it's change in the optical properties, that so by myelinization, things are harder to detect.
So the signal gets a good, nice ocular dominance problem.
Yeah.
In adults, but not with imaging.
Yeah.
And you see with 2-deoxyglucose in the adult?
It's this is a very involved issue. In the awake animal, Matthias, du weißt das. Huh? So our collaborator is an expert on this question, but I don't recall exactly. There is a way to obtain by Okay, in the adult, the method to use is proline, to inject triturated proline in the eye and look at the transport pattern. I think there's also, if you do it in awake animals, you can also 2DG map ocular dominance in adult cats. But I need to look at the papers. This is an art to detect ocular dominance in adult cats.
Okay, but the binocular regions are larger.
Then where?
In adult cats, there's more binocular cells.
No, there's no indication of that.
No, okay, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. It's
only one thing. What? People suspect that it's a change of the optical properties, that the signal to noise becomes so bad that you cannot discern the pattern, which should in principle be there. And what goes on through the first one thing that goes on and may change the optical properties through the first weeks and months of the life of a cat is that the axons, which are first not myelinated, become progressively more and more myelinated. So there are sheets enclosing the axons for the purpose of a higher conduction velocity, and those are established postnatally, only in the progression of the maturation. Because people think there's no problem because the signal is stronger. There is a clear cut. Let's do it differently. Yeah. Because the structure is clearer, the signal comes through. In the squinting animal, you have either left eye dominated cells or right eye dominated. There is virtually no binocular cell left. What did I want to say? Okay, and There are two regularities, two main regularities that have been noted so far in this comparing the layout of ocular dominance maps and of orientation preference maps. First by Grinwald and Bartfeld, I think. One thing is when you look at the angles of intersection between the border of left and right eye region and the isoorientation domain that crosses it, there are many locations where the isoorientation domains appear to preferentially cross the left-right eye border at the right angle. The other aspect in which the two maps seem to know about each other is the location of the singularities, of the places where isoorientation domains of all orientations meet in a topological defect. And you may have the impression that these singularities avoid the borders. You know, there are some that come fairly close to the border of left and right eye, but many are one that really matches the border, but many are located in the very center of the region dominated by one eye or the other. And at least in these experiments, this also worked out quantitatively. So what Mark did was to count the number of isoorientation domains that intersect left-right eye borders at a given range of orientations from 90 of angles of intersection angles from 90 to 80 degrees, to 70 degrees, and so on in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9 bins here. And there's, okay, there are all the angles present, just even tangential touching contours, but there's some tendency for isoorientation domains to rather go perpendicular through the eye dominance border. In that experiment, it also worked out for pinwheel position. To prove that, he partitioned all of the area in five subregions, each of which had the same area, But these regions were chosen such that he considered the 20% area that had the strongest eye dominance, and then the next 20 to 40% area that had the almost as high eye dominant, and so on, until this, so that this region responds. The border zones, the 20% of area where left and right eye activity or signals are almost similar, almost identical, and these 20% are the very centers of the of the eye domains. And what gives the y-axis? The y-axis gives the percentage of pinwheels within these respective areas. And again this corroborates the impression, the visual impression, that pinwheels have some tendency to be located in the center of ocular dominance columns. Not randomly, but yeah.
So when you measure the pinwheels, you present the stimulus to both eyes?
I'm not sure how they did it in that paper. I think they presented it separately to, so four orientations to one eye, four orientations to the other eye, yeah. Calculated the orientation map by pooling the eyes.
By pooling, okay, doesn't matter. So if you did it separately for two eyes, you would probably get pinwheels in a slightly shifted position.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that the pinwheels which are at the middle of the eye domains, they are somehow mostly dominated by right eyes, so pulling this together would just leave them intact. And maybe the pinwheels which are on the borders, they somehow would shift, and then by the averaging somehow.
Uh-huh.
Could be some trivial reason for this, not the...
Yeah. I heard Mark talk about this, and the check would be to calculate this for different ways of obtaining the orientation preference, and I very much hope they did it. I think they did it.
Yeah, but the way you present it would be very difficult actually to see pinwheels right at the borders between the eye domain. This would mean that for some reason for two eyes, the pinwheel would have to stay exactly in the same location. This
okay, because you don't
both eyes equal intensity, you would need to have a perfect adjustment of this fine structure of the orientation columns for both eyes.
Good point, yeah.
But if you don't have it, it's so far destroyed.
Okay, sure, check it. Yeah, what? How did Amiram process his data when he found it initially? No, he did not. He did not report this. They only. Yeah.
Map, you always pull the data from
So, the left and right equivalent statements, or
no? The right is a statement about the tendency. Okay. Aha. The right is a statement where the pinwheels are. The left is a statement what orientation the linear zones would like to have. Or do you mean whether the left implies the right?
Yeah, 90 degrees. Yeah, I don't know. Like, if are they somehow related statements?
I think they are related. From
okay.
But they are not really equivalent. Okay. You can have the one without the other. Okay. So, for example, in this squinting cat that was featured in our movie, we find that it's. Looks almost like this. There's a clear-cut tendency for perpendicular intersection, but the pinwheels fairly go everywhere and have no statistically significant preference for the center of the eye dominance. And maybe I can come to a point what mechanism or what principle is behind this. Okay, so I would like to close this part of the morning session by looking into where theory should start or may start to attack this phenomena. The problem I will focus on in the remainder of this presentation is the formation and the shaping of the layout of these maps in the visual cortex. And mechanistically or realistically, what underlies the arrangement of this orientation, ocular dominance, retinotopic columns is the wiring of the visual system, the connections through which information from retinal ganglion cells are fed effectively into the cortical circuitry, and presumably also the lateral interactions that take place in the cortex and shape responses there. So if you wish to be realistic, the formation of these structures and the principles underlying them, explaining them, are principles for the shaping of the connectivity, or should largely contain principles for the shaping of the connectivity of the system, and the dynamics for their formation would be learning rules, the ways in which synaptic connections are set up, strengthened, weakened, consolidated, removed, and so on. This is the micro level for this, and I will discuss it somewhat. Alternatively, if you would like to keep things simple, one may stick to a phenomenological level of description. So in principle, these patterns are much easier to describe than characterize the wiring of the visual pathway. For example, the pattern of orientation preferences and activities can be represented by a complex function. Just needs to know for every position x within cortex what is the angle that causes the maximum response, and maybe in addition, what is the degree of selectivity, the degree to which this maximum response is really larger than the minimum response. So this can be, for example, conveniently combined into a field of complex numbers. And then on that phenomenological level, the question is not so much one of learning rules, but, for example, whether there are simple dynamics of these other parameter fields that are sufficient to explain the main features of the observations, and whether the existence of such an effective high-level description makes experimentally testable predictions. And I will treat this level and the connection to the underlying synaptic dynamics in the afternoon, and after this short break, do something else. So thanks for your attention. And let's have a break. Okay, in this second section, I forgot something. Na gut, mach schon Nachmittag. I'd like to introduce you to arguably the most simple model for the formation of neural maps and analyze it a bit. And the reason is that basically everything that is, or the main things that are well understood at this point in time, can be easily analyzed in this example. And also it has attracted a lot of research, not only in neuroscience, but also in technical applications. And you may have get an impression why that is, and how people think neural maps may be a useful thing also for information processing. Now, this idealization, this model has been proposed initially by Toivo Kuhonen, an engineer from Finland, and he set it up like this. So what we have discussed in the up to now are orderly representations, orderly progressions of feature selectivities through the cortex. As we go through a neural structure, the features to which the neurons respond, which are processed by the neurons, change systematically. So Cohen proposed to idealize this, or many people have in fact done this. Consider an array like a chain of units, or a two-dimensional lattice of units. Okay, denote them, let's denote them by xi for the time being, and associate with every one of these units some pointer in a what's called feature space, a vector that describes the features to which this neuron xi is most sensitive, processed, represented by this neuron. And do so for all these units. Now, we have seen that sensory stimulation can change the receptive field properties. For example, in this monkey experiment, repetitive stimulation, the training, the attention of the animal, the processing of this stimulation of a particular digit led to a change in the receptive fields of the neurons and in the maps. So, to put this in mathematical form, one could say that stimuli act as forces on the receptive fields, which is they act as forces on the maps. So, in addition to this mapping from a so that associates with every unit in the model cortex some vector in the feature space, we need to describe the action of the stimuli. So we need to describe stimuli, and stimuli are most easily described just by also by vectors in the feature space. And what is the action of a stimulus is it activates the neurons in the cortical layer, and then presumably by learning processes, the selectivities of those neurons change. But only the selectivities of those neurons that are actually activated by the stimulus. So what we need in order to complete this a model for the plasticity of maps is a rule first to tell to tell the activity pattern given the state of the map from the stimulus. So to map the stimulus to an how to call it pattern of excitation in the cortex. And then another rule that tells me how the receptive fields, how the features associated with the different neurons are changed in response to this stimulus. And the simple choices Cohen advocated is to have a rule. I determine the one unit whose feature vector is most closely related, closely located to the present stimulus. Okay, this defines one unit. And then to have the activity pattern in the cortical layer to be a localized function. A neuron is always activated together with a group of neurons in its vicinity that with invariant shape centered on this neuron that best fits the stimulus. And for concreteness, I and very often people just use a Gaussian with a width sigma, which determines how many neighboring neurons are co-activated with the winning unit. So this is the first part of the game. A simple rule to associate with every stimulus given the present state of the map, an activity pattern in the cortical structure. Now, to complete the model, we have to define how the receptive fields will change due to the plasticity process. And all these plasticity experiments point in the way that a stimulus that is presented and processed attracts receptive fields of the neurons that are close to it. So this should be a force that moves these feature vectors towards the present stimulus. And the simplest choice for the change in the feature vector position is to have it to move all the feature vectors towards the stimulus that is present, but only in an amount proportional to the actual activity, so that neurons that are far away from the winning neuron and are not activated are not moved. Okay, and you can add some learning rate, which is assumed to be small, so that individual stimuli will not disrupt the pattern totally. There are different variants of this, depending on. Okay, are there questions up to now?
You define the stimulus in terms of the features, right?
Yeah.
You throw away a lot of information.
Exactly.
Which is not related to art.
Mm-hmm. So you choose some. So okay, that's where I.
The features are defined by you. You decide what features you want to represent.
In setting up such a model, you define it by choosing and declaring what you consider a feature space and so on. There are different guises of this kind of model. One called low dimensional, in which this feature space may represent something like really the orientation, an angle, or a scalar number that tells you whether left or right eye, or just the position of the receptive field. But there's no you may also define the pattern of connections as a feature vector. So for every, if you think in terms of a neural network where there is a peripheral layer, let's label it R as well, and the cortical layer, and the neuron I receives synapses W, I, J from units J in the peripheral layer. One can also write down a similar learning equation for the W, I, J. Now the thing has a different meaning. Yeah? So still, AJ, the elements of the feature vector are now the activities of the neurons in the peripheral layer, and you will recognize that the first part of this. Is the simplest variant of Happian learning rules. AJ is the, let's view it as the spike rate of the peripheral neuron. E gives the spike rate of the cortical neuron. So this is a simple Hapland learning rule, and the and this minus sign that was motivated by the wish to have the receptive field move towards the stimulus, in this view is a weight decay that is proportional to the activity of the neuron I. This synaptic weight dynamics interpretation has a few nice features that I possibly I would like to shortly mention them. So
here instead of R you have W. So
yeah.
W basically tells you the features.
Mm-hmm. W defines the features, but can be viewed as a synaptic is meant to be a synaptic weight matrix. Now these kinds of models are called self-organizing maps. And the reason why they receive this this name is that was initially that so you can now the rules are set to play a game. You throw stimuli at your system, and every stimulus leads to the leads to the to a change in the receptive fields, and then you have a new map. Throw the next stimulus at it, and what was I prepared. I hope I had prepared a simulation that lets you look. So and one, could you turn it on, please? Einfach da das. Ja, das war schon richtig. Das ist blank. Ja? Oh. Oh, und warum geht es jetzt nicht mehr? Ach so, warte mal. So, jetzt nochmal. So, jetzt müsste es aber gehen.
I thought it was in standby. Press power. Yeah. And now it's flashing me and it's either trying to cool down or come up.
Okay, how to. Wenn man nochmal drauf drückt, ändert sich nichts.
Okay. Now you probably can. And now it's off. And now you can.
Nee, es hat aufgehört zu blinken, ja? Okay, what the simulation that hopefully I will be able to show you in a second, demonstrates is the thing, the phenomenon or the observation that gave those models the name self-organizing maps. So what Cohen first investigated was when you consider a layer, or for simplicity, just a row of units, and associate random positions in the most simple of feature spaces on a line with them. And then play, throw stimuli at this system, will it be able to organize itself into an orderly structure from this random initial condition, or what will happen? This is low dimensional, so there's a 1D, what?
Inputs are just numbers.
Yeah, it's the input is one scalar number, and the output layer is neurons located on a line, everything discrete. And so now these are the locations of, these are the numbers that are put into the system. Every one of those stimuli leads to selects the unit that is closest with its receptive field, and then this unit and all the activated units undergo changes in the feature vectors. And you see that while, okay, this is a random sequence, and down here is an indication of the probability density, so homogeneously distributed random numbers in the interval. Sometimes it looks like there were sequences in there, but it's random numbers. And you see that after, okay, a few hundred of those stimuli thrown at the system from a random disordered state, it has organized itself into an orderly progression of the receptive field, such that as you go through the target layer, the positions of the of these pointers in the feature space are perfectly ordered. So this this is what gave the thing the name self-organizing map. It was able to establish an order, and this is also the reason why people try to use these and analogous algorithms in order to obtain ordered representations of stock options, of domestic products, distributions, whatever data mining applications you may want. There's actually a proof that for every initial condition, the system will in finite time enter one of the two possible ordered configurations. There are two ordered configurations, one with the with this order and the other with the inverse one. And after some insufficient trials, mathematicians managed to show that, okay, this thing is a Markov process. The probability of the possible changes of the state of the system only depend on the present state. So you can describe this probabilistically as a Markov process, and it was shown that there are only two absorbing states, these two ordered states, and that every state of the system is connected by a non-zero probability path to this ordered state. So every is okay. Neuron 1 is to the left. Neuron 2 is the next, and so and it could be the other way around. Neuron 20 is this, and neuron 90 is this, and so on. So either decreasing or increasing order. And it's a simple exercise to show, first of all, that if you have an ordered configuration, whatever stimulus you throw at the system, it cannot destroy the order. And the other thing that one has to check to prove this convergence is that for every configuration, you can choose a stimulus that will increase the order. So make two neurons that go 1, 3, 2 into 1, 2, 3. And there's a stimulus to make all these rearrangements. And this is the reason why every configuration, if you throw a random sequence of stimuli at it, will end up in this order configurations. Another feature that can be discussed in this context is what happens if the stimuli are not homogeneously distributed. Not everything happens with equal probability in your model world, but some things are very frequent and others never occur. If you choose the stimuli differently, and even the system initialized to cover all of the possible outcomings will concentrate on the likely outcomings. And okay, so this is the other aspect of the self-organization in such a map model. When you subject it to, okay, let's call this different experiences, it will with time adapt to represent the things that actually happen. And so the theoretical question connected to this behavior is, of course, how are the resources in the system distributed over the different things that may happen and need to be represented. staying with this 1D model, mapping the unit interval stimuli that are just numbers that are distributed according to some probability density function on the unit interval onto another 1D structure. Okay, and for the time being, let's go to a continuum such that the neurons are not longer indexed, but identified by their position on an interval. In that case, this map is just a map from the interval to another interval, and the property of interest is how much cortex is devoted to the processing of a unit section of the stimulus space. So this is given, this is called the aerial magnification factor in biological slang, and it's just given by the inverse gradient of the map, or the absolute value of the inverse gradient. If this is large, then a few neurons here cover a large part of the stimulus space. If this is small, a large part of the stimulus space is mapped onto a large region of the model cortex. Now, the intuitive guess is to have many neurons there where lots of stimuli are. So the intuitive guess would be to have the probability density function proportional to the aerial magnification factor. And that is a hypothesis that is very popular among biologists. On the other hand, it's not at all obvious that this will be the thing realized by this model. And one nice feature of this model is that you can actually determine the real relationship between those. And I will spend a few minutes to calculate how the resources in such a self-organizing map are distributed over the stimulus distribution. Yeah, this is the distribution of the stimuli. R of X is then the map. And what we are looking for are stationary maps that will not change under the application of stimuli, that are in equilibrium, which means that the expectation value of the change of the map should vanish. There's no expected change anymore. It's a stationary solution. And what is this? So we have to integrate over the stimuli, to average over the stimuli. Every stimulus will change the features of the neuron, but only proportional to the excitation of this neuron, which is given by the distance, by its distance in the cortex from the winning units. So we have here a mapping from stimulus to the winning unit, and this is just the inverse of the map in this case. Because it's 1D to 1D, it is invertible, and the neuron whose R is closest to S is just the inverse mapping applied to the stimulus. Now, I said for simplicity, let's use this or a similar peaked function of size sigma and consider the case, and this should vanish. And now let's consider the case where this sigma is a small number. Okay, for this assumption, we can actually solve this equation for the magnification factor. And there are two steps here. Okay.
The equation for R of
N. Yeah. first of all, so this is an integral equation for R and its inverse, but it's easy to transform it into one only for R by changing the integration variable. Instead of integrating over the stimuli, we now integrate over the corresponding cortical neurons. But, okay, what is this? Okay, in principle, there are these absolute values, but let's have it ordered such that this thing is positive. Okay, the density at the point of the receptive field of this neuron. So, okay, the transform is S becomes R of Y, R of X is kept, and then we have this E of now X minus Y. Since this function has a small support, as non-zero only in a short region, it is a sensible thing to approximate R of Y, because this will only contribute in the very vicinity of the X by a power series. And that's so. X is no. This must be satisfied for every x. Yeah. So it's an integral function for the function R of X. So, okay. What do the different terms become? The Jacobian becomes becomes this. The density expanded is density at the reference point and what else do we have to plug in? Okay, and this difference is just okay, and all these are not equalities, so there are neglected terms up there. Plug this into this. There is no zeroth order term because this factor is lowest order linear. The linear terms will vanish when it's integrated over y. So the only terms that enter in at this truncation are those that are quadratic in y minus x, and that gives you a factor sigma square in front of all of them.
The integral of y minus x should vanish. It's only true if x is in the middle.
This is an even function. Okay, let's have periodic boundary conditions. Yeah? Periodic boundary conditions. Yeah, no edges. If you have boundaries at the edges, the neurons get compressed. Okay. For simplicity, let's have periodic or infinite cortex, infinite. Yeah, for instance. Yeah, that's the size of the system, which should be much larger. So, this you can write is this system size, and also sigma should be smaller than the typical. No, it need not be. No. Yeah, and should be smaller than the rate of change of rho.
But this is projected by sigma itself.
What?
The scale of the map is determined by sigma. So why should the map not become part of the map?
There's no reduction of the dimension here. It's just a map 1D to 1D, or you can do the same thing for N to N. Okay, what do we get? There's one term that has the second derivative. It is here. And it must go with these two. So and there are two terms, this. Oh, it's actually the same. Yeah? So it has. Yeah, so one R. One derivative, the second, the third, and the first derivative of the density evaluated at R. And the third term is this, which is the same as the first term I wrote here, so one half becomes three halves. And all of this in the for stationary map must vanish. A little algebra on this gives you either this expression, you have the second derivative of R and R prime times the logarithmic derivative of rho of R times R prime is zero. So in this representation, you already see that it cannot be achieved that the magnification factor exactly cancels the stimulus density. Because, what is this? This is the probability of activation within cortex. This is a function of x. So every x, it gives you the probability with which unit x will be activated. So if this is flat in the case of the R dash being rho 1 over rho, the second derivative of R must be zero, so this can only hold for straight maps, for linear maps. In general, this term must be non-zero, such that the implying that the error magnification and the stimulus density must not cancel. And exactly one finds that So you can solve this for the magnification factor. And one finds that in 1D, it is not proportional to the density of stimuli, but to the density to the power of 2/3. meaning that the high probability stimuli are relatively underrepresented, and low probability stimuli are represented by a larger area than by a map that would make the probability of activation of the cortical units flat. Did I lose everybody? Who's with me still? Okay, now let's connect this to biology. It's fairly abstract. Now,
so which cortical units are used the most then? The ones.
Okay. Let's do it. Let's calculate it. I mean, the probability. So what is? This is the thing we want to know. So this is to the 3/2. Okay. But we want it in terms of the density. Mm. This is okay. So to the
row R times the minus here.
No. If here's the minus. One. Okay. The inverse is minus 2/3. Okay. Yeah, it's still the most, the neurons that represent the most probable stimulus are the most activated.
Okay.
So it's not flattened enough. Now there's still a peak in the activation probability. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If rho is
always, okay, and the order, so the probabilities of the activation go in the same order as the probabilities of the stimulus.
Yeah.
So it's just that the multiplication factor is not there, but mm-hmm. you get the right order.
Yeah. The neurons that decide to go for the highly likely stimuli get the burden that they have to be more active than the lazy ones.
But it's compressed. In the 1/3,
yeah. The peak in the cortical activation density is less pronounced than the peak in the sensory activation probability. But this is okay. This was 1D. With a bit more algebra, you can do it for end-to-end mappings, and you end up with the same equation. Now, R of x is a mapping from an n-dimensional vector to an n-dimensional vector, and the second derivative becomes a Laplacian, and the derivative of R becomes the gradient. Is it true? No, it's becomes the divergence. Ah, Quatsch. Becomes the Jacobian matrix. Applied to the gradient of this probability of activation. Yep. Okay, again, so in n dimensions, you have to multiply the density with the Jacobian of the transformation. So this is, for example, in 2D, the would be the expression for the cortical activation probability. And in 2D, now you see there's a chance to have alpha of x constant. The map must be harmonic. So we already know a special solution. It is this complex logarithm and its shifted versions. So the approximate guess of the observed retinotopic organization in the primate is actually a solution of the 2D coholon model, and it is such a solution that gives you a constant probability of activation for the units.
For any
realm? No, now it depends. Okay, if this is constant, then and we have R proportional to the logarithm. Is it right? No. Yeah.
And then find the riddle for which that satisfies this equation.
Exactly. Yeah. So, which means.
What is the riddle for which complex
logarithm? 1 over R. Since the Jacobian of the complex logarithm is. So, this is the inverse. This is R for the complex logarithm, so to have to cancel those, the density must be 1 over R, which somewhat fits the ganglion density in the primate eye. So this is one special solution. Should I? Okay, now, of course, the real thing will be a complex logarithm whose pole is shifted to the other visual hemifield. So this divergence is outside of the range of applicability. Okay.
So why
yeah.
do you want it to be, why do you want the magnification factor to be exactly 1/1?
Why do you want the cortical activity to be flat?
Principle of
yeah.
So this is the possibility of activation will be flat on the cortex.
Yeah.
So all of the cortex neurons will have the same chance to get activated.
Yeah.
For this you need to activate mostly the foreground.
In the
you have a specific shape of the cortex. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah. Given the map in the primate, if you have algebraic or 1 over R increase in the activity towards the fovea, then the cortical activity density is flat. All the neurons have the same amount of work to do. I don't know. Do you know? It's about true. Huh?
It's hard to interpret this because this is this long dimensional variant, so all the inputs are treated as just one.
Number. Okay, very good. So, but you could derive it from a synaptic model. That's an.
Also, I'm not. The crucial assumption is also that sigma is the same all over the cortex.
Yeah. For example.
You want the cortex yep. to be unit. So makes sense. Sigma, let's say, probability.
I mean, for example, these columns are about the same size, the ocular dominance and the orientation preference, whether you are in the periphery or in the center. In a minute, you will see that in almost all the models, the sigma is what sets the size of the column. So there's quite a bit of evidence that the sigma should be a fairly homogeneous thing, or at least the same order of magnitude. Now, in the remaining time, the one thing I would like to show you before the break is what happens when instead of mapping an n-dimensional feature space onto an n-dimensional cortex, you want to have the cortex represent a feature space that is of higher dimension than its own the manifold, 2D or 1D in a model. So, reicht das aus? The situation we look at is Okay, let's consider a 1D cortex for simplicity, and a 2D feature space, which is the lowest dimensionality feature space that requires dimension reduction. And let's have a density of stimuli in this feature space, which is, so this is now a 2D vector, which only depends on one direction. So it's homogeneous along this axis, and let's assume symmetric and of finite support in the y direction. So this is sy, and this is sx, and the density of stimuli should be homogeneous in the x direction, invariant, homogeneous in this direction, but peaked and of finite support in the other direction. Yeah, or y could be the ocular dominance and x could be the eccentricity. It's just the simplest example. And if you go to higher dimensions, as long as the input dimension is larger than the output dimension, all the results will come out just like in this example. So this map is now a map from the line of real numbers into this R2. And because, okay, since we assume that this is an even function, we also know one solution, which is to have R of x ignore this additional direction. For every stimulus, whatever its sy component is, it will always be mapped to the same point. So the y component of the stimulus by this mapping will be ignored. It does not play a role for the cortical activation pattern. So this solution is there for symmetry and plays the role of the homogeneous solution from which others may bifurcate in pattern formation problems. So what we have to investigate is the stability of this solution. If I initialize the system with a small deviation from this, will it grow or will it decay? Now, what is the dynamics of R of x? Let's consider this on a long time scale, such that when very many stimuli must occur before a substantial change in R of x happens. So this, the relevant dynamics is something like the average change according to this modification rule. Let's consider this as the deterministic dynamics of the average R. What's the right-hand side? It's now a 2D integral. Of the same type as over there. And we would like to linearize this in the vicinity of this homogeneous state of this ignorant solution. Now, the difference between the 1 to 1 and the 1 to 2, or 2 to 1 case, is that we can no longer have an inverse of the winner neuron, because whatever the state of this thing is, always a whole line of stimuli will be mapped onto the same winning neuron. Okay, so it's not here. Yeah, it's an interesting question. If this is a very shallow deviation, then the line that is orthogonal to the local gradient vector contains all the neurons that are mapped onto this point and onto this thing. If the all these stimuli that are on the line perpendicular to the tangent will be mapped onto this point. Because this is the what?
Is that an assumption?
No, that's the that follows from this closeness rule. You want to map to that neuron whose receptive field is closest to the stimulus. Because the straight line is the shortest path, this one is the closest neuron. But this works only for shallow deviations. Okay, yeah, I said for shallow deviations. If you have something like this, then there's a there's an intersection here, and all those neurons map to them, to this one, and all those stimuli in this part map to this one, and those map to this one. So there are two regimes to be. So there's a simple regime of small deviations from the ignorant state, in which there's a simple rule to find the. Yeah, but I mean, a small deviation also has a small derivative. If it's small enough, I mean, okay, let's have it epsilon, and have, you can always have the, for whatever frequency is in there, you can have it so small that there's no such. Okay, that's why I said finite support. This will always happen if you go out far enough. But if there's finite support, there's for every deviation. There's a small enough deviation of every frequency for which this map will work.
Yeah, I still understand the formulation of the problem. X star of S is the map from the two-dimensional space to the one-dimensional vortex, right? So I thought you want to just find what X star of S would be. But you're, it seems to be you're assuming something about X star of S.
I want to, I mean, to know R of X or to know X star of S is equivalent. If you know this, you know this. The other way around is not true, yeah?
I don't understand how you would assume nothing about X star of S and then derive what X star of S has to be.
I would like to, okay, I know a solution of R of X, this solution, the homogeneous one, which ignores the second feature, and study its dynamics, whether it is stable or unstable. Okay. So I want a equation of motion for R of X. And there's, but the same game can be used to get rid of the, a similar game can be used to get rid of this X star.
But why should I only look at the perturbations that respect this constancy along a line?
Constancy along, the, okay, the linear stability is the question whether a small deviation will grow or decay. I want the X star for a small deviation in order to derive the dynamics for a small deviation. That's the, there's no principal reason. This is yeah, exactly. Okay, let's do it. So now we cannot go from a perfectly from an integral over the stimuli to an integral over the cortex, but at least halfway. So let's use it. Yeah.
What is the equation of motion?
The equation of motion, okay. Yeah, it's okay. This is the individual stimulus thing. Now let's take epsilon to zero and the number of stimuli to infinity such that the product is constant, then R of X will, in the limits, have this deterministic dynamics, right? Okay, so let's have a change of variables that makes use of this simple mapping rule. So for every stimulus S will be parameterized by the position of the neuron that is representing it, plus a second parameter that tells you how far it is away from the solution. So, and this vector, well, because, okay, what do we have? There's this tangential vector, which is in general this one, so the perpendicular vector is minus dyr dxr. Right? And now to reach the stimulus S, to parameterize it, I start from a feature vector of the neurons, and then follow the perpendicular thing. So delta times Blödsinn, y and x. So this is the y component of R, and this is the x component of R. So when this is the map, and this is a stimulus, I take the closest point, and then go perpendicular to the tangent into stimulus space. And in this way, I parameterize the stimuli by the winning neurons and the deviation from the map. Okay. Now let's evaluate the dynamics of R using this. Now we have to integrate over the winning neurons, which is equivalent to the Y integration over there. And the deviations of the stimuli from the map weighted with the Jacobian of the mapping and now we have S of X star and delta minus R of X. And we have X star of S out of the game.
So delta is measures the distance along this normal.
Yeah, it is not really the distance because it also depends, but it's proportional to the distance. What time is it? Okay. In the lunch break, you can linearize this equation, and what you will find is that the dynamics of the y component, the zero component in this solution, in the vicinity of this solution, is okay. Now this is a 2D vector. It has an x and a y component. Now is there still space here? Is this solution plus some small deviation, Rx, Ry, x. This is little r. It is the small deviation from the homogeneous map. It has a decay term that may stabilize it, and it has a term that can destabilize it. It is proportional to the variance of delta The variance of SY. Inverse proportional to the sigma square in the activity. And this second term is a convolution operator that convolves the second derivative of the small deviation with this Gaussian. Yeah, this is a constant. This is just a number, but
that's uniform in
X. Yeah.
Distribution of.
Yeah. Okay. But you can have different distributions which are wide or small, and the stability of the thing will depend on the ratio between this additional feature dimension and the cortical cooperation length. So, and after the lunch break, I will discuss the spectrum of this and then come to applications.